You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's look at the intersection of popular culture, politics, and sociology. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'll be joined every second and fourth Wednesday mornings by a series of guests as we examine everything from the depiction of American government in film and television to notable themes in various genres of cinema. For more information or to access previous shows and related essays, head to www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org. If there's one thing that's synonymous with summertime when it comes to Hollywood, it's the blockbuster action film. What sorts of genres gave birth to American action movies? How have they been impacted by the politics of their respective eras? And what sorts of qualities separate effective action movies from the more unfortunate entries in the genre? My guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, a film scholar who's lectured at Loyola Marymount University and also is the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, Violence, Spectacle, and the American Action Movie. Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLEW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show, we'll be talking about the world of action cinema, everything from the pivotal films that have shaped the genre to the relationship between the action genre and shifts in political and societal attitudes over the past few decades. My guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, a film scholar who's contributed commentaries to DVDs of various landmark action pictures. He's also contributed to Slate and The Hollywood Reporter and lectured at Loyola Marymount University. And he is the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, which is billed as an authoritative and entertaining study of the action film. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks, Ken. It's good to be here.
So, Eric, this is certainly an appropriate time to talk about this subject, since here we are at the start of the summer. Summertime has long been associated with action films. And I'd like to begin by talking about the birth of the modern action movie. How do we define the genre, and when did it come into existence?
Well, I think that the genre was really born out of several other genres. The Western, film noir, and the police procedural. And the police procedural is the one that I think is most often forgotten in that mix. The modern action movie, and I think it's important to call it the modern action movie because we've always had a tradition of action and adventure in our films, and we've always had the need for action and adventure and spectacle. Usually that need was filled by other genres, the Western, the combat film, the swashbuckler, and so on. But I think the modern action movie, the flashpoint was in 1971 with the release of Dirty Harry. Dirty Harry was the first modern action movie because of the particular way it combined elements from the Western, the noir, and the police procedural. Particularly, not only did you have a hero of the Western now in an urban police thriller, but it was also the way the film approached police work. Harry Callahan is not really interested in solving crime. What he's interested in is in stopping criminals violently, obliterating them. In fact, if you look at the movie carefully, I'm pretty sure there isn't a single moment when Harry or any of the people associated with him ask, well, who is this killer? They're not even interested in his identity. It's just a question of, do we stop him or do we not stop him? And Dirty Harry is really playing off of certainly the Western approach to justice and the law, and its interest in violence and in brutality, and also its strange sexual undercurrent is taken from noir, but it's also a film that's made both in the tradition of and in opposition to the police procedurals of the time. Dirty Harry was actually supposed to be played by Frank Sinatra, and Sinatra had to drop out to a hand surgery that he hadn't recovered from. So the much more laconic Clint Eastwood stepped in. And if you look at Dirty Harry, and if you look at the original screenplay in which the character is much more verbose, you can really see that this would have been a film much more like Frank Sinatra's The Detective or Tony Roma or any of those more verbal, somewhat more cerebral police procedurals.
Yeah, with Dirty Harry, you know, you're talking about stopping the criminal. It almost seems more like a military mindset. You know, they don't care about the political ramifications or why they're going into war. It's all about defeating the enemy on the battlefield.
I think that's a great observation. And Clint Eastwood, in interviews in the past, has kind of famously rejected reading too much into the politics of the movie. And the movie, I think, is made in that great Hollywood tradition of being all things to all people. Conservatives can like it because of its approach to justice and law and order and stopping the criminals, kind of a Nixonian approach. And liberals can like the movie because Harry is so anti-authority. He just rejects whatever anybody tries to tell him to do. So the movie kind of straddles it in a pretty good Rorschach test for audiences in that way.
So what were the other landmark pictures of the 70s in addition to Dirty Harry that ushered in the action genre?
There were a good number of them. Certainly Death Wish, with Charles Bronson as the archetypal urban vigilante. Interestingly, and I write about this in the book, he is very much a reformed liberal. Also in the book I add Taxi Driver, which is more than just an action movie, of course, but which really cemented that idea of the vigilante and deepened its connections to the Western myth and to the conventions of film noir. But the thing about the 70s that's also really important, and again, this is a point I make in that chapter, is that this is a time when the genre is still figuring itself out. It's experimenting with its conventions. It's kind of unformed. It's not until the 80s that the genre becomes more consistent, more classical.
And just for our listeners, Death Wish is a film with Charles Bronson where his, I think he plays an architect.
That's right.
And his wife and daughter get attacked, and I think his wife is killed and daughter's raped, and basically he turns into this vigilante who hunts down criminals on the streets of New York City.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes Death Wish very interesting in that regard, there's several things. One is that the film's racial politics, the assailants are all white, which is not to say that his victims are. But the assailants are all white, and one of them, I believe, was the featured film debut of Jeff Goldblum. In fact, not only are they white, the implication is that they're Nazis. But the other thing that's interesting is that, unlike a lot of these kinds of revenge pictures, including the Death Wish sequels, where the hero or anti-hero goes out and finds the guys who did this thing and punishes them for it, in Death Wish, the original, they get away with it. And the Charles Bronson character, he never goes after them. He goes after criminals in general. And as the film plays out, that quest is so open-ended, there's no way to satisfy it. It can't end any way but badly for him. And so Death Wish, which I think a lot of people forget, is that there's kind of an implied critique of this vigilante myth, much more so than in some other films, including the sequels and the first Dirty Harry. Once we get to the 80s, that kind of self-critique, which is there in Dirty Harry, and it's certainly there in Taxi Driver and some other films, that self-critique starts to fade out of the picture. And violence becomes not just the sort of morally necessary but morally ambiguous solution to the problem, it becomes the intuitive solution to the problem. And I think that's kind of the first chilling moment in the evolution of the genre.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And today we're discussing the world of action cinema. And my guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, who is a film scholar, who has also contributed analysis to various publications such as Slate and The Hollywood Reporter. He's also the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, which is a study of the action film throughout the last few decades. And talking about the action films in the 80s, we seem to have this transformation from, say, the everyman, like a guy like Charles Bronson, who, you know, at least in the Death Wish films, he's portrayed just as a guy that you might, you know, find anywhere. Even Clint Eastwood, in comparison a guy like Schwarzenegger or a guy like Stallone or the martial artists that we saw later in the decade, guys like Steven Seagal, those are basically seen as larger-than-life sorts of figures.
In the 70s, a guy like Clint Eastwood was sort of that kind of height of masculinity. But times change and vogues change, and in the 80s, yeah, we did have these kind of supermen whose heroism was so much more grounded in their physical body, these muscle men of Schwarzenegger and Stallone and these martial artists a little later on, like Jean-Claude Van Damme and Steven Seagal, and, you know, and of course we can't forget Chuck Norris. And so often their movies would embody this idea of bodily purity in almost a creepy way very often. You know, Cobra is a great example with Sylvester Stallone. He's always sort of encased in black leather behind his sunglasses. He eats pizza wearing black leather gloves.
Can you talk about Cobra for a little bit?
Oh, I can talk about Cobra for a
while. Well, for our listeners, it's just a...
Cobra is a pretty interesting film. I've always said that if I could only put one movie from the 80s, particularly the mid-80s, into a time capsule, it would be Cobra. Which is not to say it is a great movie. It's actually, I think, a fairly terrible movie, but it is just, there's just so much you can unpack. you can see so much of what was happening, not only in Hollywood and in mainstream American cinema, but also in American political and cultural life. It's a really rich, very dense movie that way. The movie stars Sylvester Stallone as a Los Angeles homicide detective, who, of course, takes on the cases nobody else wants. There's a moment when Brigitte Nielsen asks him, what do you do to relax? And he says, I look for trouble. He's that guy. And he's on the trail of the Night Slasher, who is this serial killer terrorizing Los Angeles. And Cobra is the only cop, Cobra and his partner are the only two cops, who think that they might be dealing with not just one killer, but a whole army. In fact, my favorite scene in the movie is after this car chase where you have two members of the gang chasing Cobra and his partner. So you have a bunch of vehicles involved in this chase. After that, Cobra's dunderheaded superiors still insist that they're only dealing with one killer. I mean, the lengths that Stallone as screenwriter goes to make other people wrong and his character right is just stunning. But what's so interesting about the hero and the villains in this movie is that we talked a minute ago about how Stallone is just sort of encased in leather, and he's so well armored against all kinds of impurities that are out there running around in the world. The leader of the gang, on the other hand, is like this primitive force. He grunts and he sweats and he's just simian. And he is so crazy, he becomes physically other. And he really is a monster that the very pure Stallone has to destroy. And so the movie is taking psychosis and making that a stand-in for race, really, the way Indians were portrayed in Westerns and the way African-Americans have been portrayed in, you know, some of our lesser-minded exploitation movies. It's the same dynamic, but here it's just a tiny bit more PC because they're not minorities, they're just crazy. But it's that same kind of equivalence. And the film is relentlessly obsessed with style and fashion. The narrative is stitched together by music videos. It's really that sort of classic 80s mainstream filmmaking.
And Stallone is a guy, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Ronald Reagan in the 80s for pictures like Rambo, The First Blood Part 2, yeah. And also with Rocky 4, where he ends the Cold War by defeating Ivan Drago in the ring.
Yeah.
And so he's so much this iconic figure. What would you say the impact of the Reagan administration was on the action film of the 80s?
Well, that's a great question. There was certainly a large impact of the Reagan administration on the action film, just as there was a large impact of the action film on the Reagan administration. There was the famous episode when Reagan challenged Gaddafi by saying, go ahead, make my day. There was an episode where Reagan was caught on a live mic joking around about, after a hostage crisis, that he'd just seen Rambo and next time he'll know what to do. As far as how did the Reagan administration influence the genre, they kind of grew up together, in a way. Reagan ran a campaign based on this idea of mourning in America, you know, regeneration, renewal. And that was an incredibly important part of the genre's ethos at the time, particularly in that rash of post-apocalyptic adventures where it's all about either getting out of the wasteland or finding some kind of physical and spiritual renewal. We were really kind of obsessed with Armageddon during that time, the height of the Cold War. And that idea of destruction, but then regeneration, how they go hand in hand, birth from death, all of that, a very important part of the genre. And I think the Reagan administration was helping to kind of get that into the groundwater.
I definitely want to talk about the post-apocalyptic film. But one other point concerning Stallone I think is interesting is that the Rambo series started with First Blood, which came out back in 81. And here, the film is chronicling the story of his character who comes back from Vietnam, who finds out that he can't get a job and his friends are dying of cancer from Agent Orange. Mm-hmm. And the film turns into this critique of the American government, which I think it's interesting how that is suddenly transformed over the next few years to have him become this American icon.
That's a great observation. And the thing you want to remember about the series, though, is that particularly in that second film, which is the most iconic, it's also an indictment of the American government. Even though he is doing work on behalf of the American government, he repudiates it at the end. What do we want? We want a country that loves us as much as we loved it. You know, it's the American military bureaucrat who forsakes Rambo. And it's the same thing that we saw at work in Dirty Harry, that he represents this ideal of being anti-authority. So yes, he's an American icon, but he's not a tool of the American government. He is his own man, and that is truly the ideal of the American hero that you trace back to the Western gunfighter.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and today under surveillance, we're talking about the world of action cinema, everything from the pivotal films that have shaped the genre to the relationship between action and shifts in political and societal attitudes over the last few decades. And my guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, who is the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, which is an authoritative and entertaining study of the action film. And talking a little bit about action icons such as Sylvester Stallone and also Arnold Schwarzenegger. And it seems that despite the fact that we've had certainly a very aggressive national foreign policy in this country, at least during the George W. Bush years, we've seemed to see the disappearance of those kinds of heroes. We've had Denzel Washington play lots of detectives, but we don't think of him as an action star in the same way that we thought of Clint Eastwood as an action star. And we've also had actors like The Rock and Vin Diesel, who would seem to exhibit those kinds of over-the-top, superhuman qualities that we saw in Stallone and Schwarzenegger, but they've never seen their careers take off in that same manner. It seems like that style of film has waned in popularity. Now, why do you think that that is?
Well, I think that started in the late 80s and early 90s, when some action movies tried to distinguish themselves with more average Joe heroes. So pretty soon, Bruce Willis and Nicolas Cage were becoming the genre's go-to guys. Also, the Schwarzeneggers and the Stallones, they were supermen. And by the late 90s, we had a glut of actual supermen in our movies. You know, with comic book adaptations and CG, the genre started taking an otherworldly bent that was more overt than it had been for much of the 80s. And the muscle men and the martial artists you're talking about, they filled a need for spectacle. And over the years, it's not that the need left us, it's that new things came along to fill it. And so those older types, the Schwarzeneggers, the Stallones, they started to seem more antiquated. If you're talking about at least the 90s, Schwarzenegger did make more of a successful transition into that decade than Stallone did. Going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, Stallone was such an icon of the 80s and so tied to that Reaganism, he didn't escape it nearly as well as Schwarzenegger did. But I do think it was first the rise of the common man hero and then the literal superhero that did in the Schwarzenegger and Stallone modes.
Well, I think also Schwarzenegger seemed to exhibit a sense of humor on camera. So he's able to do the films like Kindergarten Cop and like Twins. And you know, I think Stallone had a film called Oscar. I think he plays a mafia don that was allegedly a comedy that was dead on arrival. And so
Stop
I think
Or My Mom Will Shoot.
You Stop or My Mom, yeah, with Estelle Getty. Yes,
yeah.
I forgot about that.
In on that pitch.
So I think that's also a clear distinction that at least Schwarzenegger, while no one would think of him as Laurence Olivier, I mean, the guy had a lot more acting range than perhaps a guy like Stallone. Even before the superhero films really kick into high gear in the late 90s, what would you say would be the landmark action films of the early and mid-90s?
Well, I think you're looking at a few different trends. You're looking at the Die Hard on a something, right? So we had Die Hard in 1988 and then Die Hard 2 in 1990. And then for the next, really through Air Force One in 1997, it seemed like half the genre was taken up by Die Hard on a bus, Die Hard on a boat, Die Hard on a train, Die Hard on any one of a number of airplanes.
Of the speed films with Keanu Reeves, sure.
Yeah. And you also had the return of the disaster movie in the mid to late 90s. So you had a couple of volcano movies in there. You had a couple of asteroid movies in there. And one of the points I make in the book is that the genre is never static. It's never just one trend, and it's never just one trend at a time. So in the 90s, we do kind of see this split into the more spectacle-driven disaster movies and also that Die Hard on a something. But certainly, as far as specific films, Speed, Terminator 2, I think those would have to be on the top of anybody's list of landmark early and mid-90s action pictures.
Oh, and in terms of Terminator 2, which is a film with Arnold Schwarzenegger and also Lyndall Hamilton, in the first film, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a cyborg who goes back in time to assassinate Lyndall Hamilton's character because she's going to give birth to the future of human resistance when Armageddon hits a period of time from then. And Terminator 2, which came out back in 91, you know, she's very much bulked up, much more muscular for the role. She's certainly this kind of commando-type figure. People have talked before about Aliens, the mid-80s movie with Sigourney Weaver, and Terminator 2 as being these landmark films as far as action heroines. Why do you think that in recent years it's been much more common to see females in those kinds of tough guy roles?
That's certainly true on television, isn't it? Buffy and Alias were real breakthroughs for action heroines on the small screen. And as far as the big screen, we see that every few years. We see one or two big movies come out with female heroes, and everyone gets very excited, and people start writing, you know, is this finally the establishment of the action movie heroine? And it always seems to just go away. You know, it's like a tide that just comes in and comes back out and comes in and goes back out. The most recent example of this I can think of is when Elektra and Catwoman opened around the same time and both failed. And it seemed that Hollywood's takeaway from that was audiences aren't really interested in female heroes. They're still not really interested in female heroes. And I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I just think that maybe it's even more important to make a good movie if you're going to rest it on the shoulders of a female hero.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and today we're talking all about the world of action cinema. And my guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, who is a film scholar, who is the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, which discusses violence, spectacle, and the American action movie. And you mentioned before, talking about the post-apocalyptic movies that came out in the early and mid-80s, dealing with the aftermath of this potential nuclear war. The Road Warrior is, I think, probably the landmark picture of that sort of subgenre. The Road Warrior takes place in Australia, featuring Mad Max, who is played by young Mel Gibson. And it's basically a war over oil in the future after nuclear wars hit and civilization has basically evaporated. And you have this classic battle between biker gangs and the last outpost of civilization. And you spend a great deal of time in the book talking about the film. And also how influential it was, you know, in the coming apocalyptic films after that.
Well, I think it's certainly a masterpiece. It holds up not only because it takes place in another time and place, but because it's set in a timeless place. It's the desert. It's the wasteland. There's less in each frame to date the movie. Then again, you do have a lot of leather and feathers, so you know, there's that. But it's a very simple story. So perfectly told, made very much in the tradition of Shane and of classic Westerns, that in some ways I think The Road Warrior is the perfect action movie in the sense that it's so directly connected to its mythological roots. It doesn't dress them up or hide them very much at all. The movie is practically pure myth, and I think that's one of the reasons it is timeless and will remain timeless for decades to come.
And the last third of this movie deals with this epic chase where Mel Gibson's driving this oil tanker and he's basically running the gauntlet against the entire biker gang. This film came out in 1981, directed by George Miller, and you mentioned that it still holds up very well. Here we are at 2009, 28 years later. And I think that's something that it's tougher for the action film to do, perhaps, compared to other genres of film. You know, in the book you mentioned films like Shaft and The French Connection, both seen as iconic action movies of the 70s. And in The French Connection, you have what's billed as this just landmark car chase with Gene Hackman. You know, watching the film today, I would think that it just doesn't hold up very well because, well, you know, you've seen what's been done with special effects in the 2 decades in between that film, or 3 decades in between that film and today. And so it kind of leaves you a bit wanting.
Well, that's an interesting question. There are different ways a movie becomes dated. One is just the stuff that's in the frame and on the actors. And in that way, Mel Gibson's haircut in Lethal Weapon probably dates about as fast as Mary Tyler Moore's in Ordinary People. But another is more technological, and that includes everything from sound recording equipment and film stock to what I think your question is really getting at, which is special effects. And since the action genre is so dependent on spectacle, as special effects technology advances, yes, older films they may date a little faster than the films of other genres. But your question, I think, is important for another reason, especially when you bring up The Chase and The French Connection. Philip D'Antoni produced The French Connection, and that car chase, certainly landmark, took place over the streets of New York. Bullet was another film of his made a few years before, and with Steve McQueen. That car chase, that was through, over the hills of San Francisco. I think what's essential here is not, is the sequence dated? It's, is it effective? You know, about a year ago, I saw Bullet on the big screen again. For the record, I don't consider Bullet to be an action movie, per se, or The French Connection, for that matter. But we are talking about those famous car chases, a fixture of the action genre. And so, sure, you know, you look at Bullet, you look at The French Connection. The film was grainier than today's digital stuff is. But seeing it on the big screen with a crowd, I mean, that chase is still absolutely thrilling. And with a lot of the action movies today, I look at the sequences, and of course they are much more technologically sophisticated, but I'm not sure what it is I'm supposed to be experiencing. You know, is it genuine excitement, or is it just this kind of sensory overload? And very often I think it's the latter. So digital technology has done a lot for us, but I don't think it's necessarily helped our sense of craftsmanship.
Well, I totally agree as far as sensory overload. I think even the recent Star Trek picture, which critics have loved, I was kind of lukewarm on the film. I think, I don't know if you've, have you seen the Star Trek movie?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, because it seemed that, if you're talking about, if you look at Star Trek back in the 80s, and around Wrath of Khan, and the kind of slow cat and mouse chase between the ships that are kind of drifting throughout space, kind of like these old naval vessels. Mm-hmm. And here you have the 2009 Star Trek, where you have a million explosions on screen, ships hurtling all over the place, you can't really make out what's happening. You've got lights and buzzers and sound effects, and it seems to be a very, very different sort of experience, and I don't think that's one that kind of generates that same sort of tension.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's a fair comparison. The final battle in The Wrath of Khan is a sub-hunt, straight out of maybe a World War II movie. But what is it you want to compare the new Star Trek to? You know, to older Star Trek or to current summer blockbusters? Both are fair comparisons. I think what's kind of miraculous about this movie is that it is a summer blockbuster that is as faithful to classic Star Trek as it is. One of the things that's really important about this new Star Trek movie is that it's a film with a genuinely credible story, well-sketched characters, very nicely turned performances, and I think that, as much as if not more than the action, is what the critics and, frankly, the audiences are responding to. And it's particularly interesting given really how compromised a brand Star Trek was going into this summer. I hope its success is the story of this summer, because I think there's something very instructive about that.
I guess my point is that I never really saw Star Trek as an action show or the preceding films as action films. So it seems that certainly the new film sort of encroaches more on that type of ground.
I think that's definitely true. I think that reflects the summer blockbuster quality of this film, you know, the water that Paramount had this film swimming in. And I think that what it does with the action, and I take your point about the craftsmanship of the action. I think it's better than in a lot of movies like it, but it's still, I won't say I was never disoriented or any of that. But I think that the way this movie is using action is pretty interesting. It reminded me in a very strange way, going back to the 80s, of Star Trek IV, the one with the whales, in the sense that the way that film used comedy to broaden the audience for the franchise, that's how this movie uses action.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And I'm talking to Eric Lichtenfeld, who is the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder on Violence, Spectacle, and the American Action Movie. And you're talking a few moments ago about sensory overload. And that certainly seems to be the case with a director of a new film that just came out this week, the new Transformers movie directed by Michael Bay. Certainly not a critically acclaimed director by any sense, but he did films like Pearl Harbor. He certainly the first Transformers film.
The Bad Boys film.
Bad Boys,
yeah. The Rock, Armageddon, The Island.
The new Transformers film has been almost universally panned by critics. Roger Ebert wrote a very entertaining one-star review of the film that came out a couple of days ago. And his response, as you indicated in the book, has always been, well, just look at the box office receipts. Who cares if critics like me or not? What are your thoughts on directors like Bay who succeed, it seems to be almost solely on the strength of these kinetic action sequences and the special effects?
I have a number of thoughts on the good or not Michael Bay, and I get into a lot of them in the book. And in fact, I've had people tell me it's their favorite part of the book. He does have a definite history of using his movies' box office success to diminish his critics. And that's really unfortunate because he does it to position himself as some kind of vanguard of the common man and to stoke hostility toward intellectuals and anything that smacks of the intellectual. He said things like, critics don't like me because I make Armageddon instead of Schindler's List. You know? But that's not true. They don't like him because he makes bad Armageddons. Now, full disclosure, I haven't seen the new Transformers yet. I just haven't had the time, and frankly, I don't know anyone who has had the time. But everything that I've read or heard is consistent with my thoughts on the first film and my thoughts on the other films he's made. The first Transformers film, and if this applies to the new one, it applies to the new one. The first one is a giant fighting robot movie that's chaotic and racist and dumb. Now, does that mean audiences want fighting robot movies that are chaotic and racist and dumb? Or does it mean they want fighting robot movies? And if they're chaotic, racist, and dumb, then so be it. It's hard to know for sure, but I do think it's interesting that Star Trek has done so well, again, largely on the strength of its characters and its story and its performances. Yes, and on its action and special effects. And the other interesting difference is that as movie franchises go, Transformers was a big brand with a big star or two, and Star Trek was a much weaker brand with no stars.
You talked in the book about how, if you look at the popularity of superhero films, I mean, this is a genre that people thought, wow, it was just kid stuff 30 years ago. And now you have very mature films like The Dark Knight, for instance. Even the Spider-Man films were certainly aimed at older audiences than, say, the Spider-Man cartoons of a few decades ago. Hollywood has certainly been able to adapt these kinds of stories for older audiences. So it's interesting that a guy like Michael Bay, just, hey, let me put as many explosions up there on screen as I can, and that's what the audience wants to experience, and if the critics want anything more, then to hell with them.
Well, yeah, and you brought up Roger Ebert a moment ago, and Ebert wrote something that I thought was interesting, which was, he said that Michael Bay, at age 44, had made Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, and he compares that to Steven Spielberg at age 47 making Schindler's List. And he talks about how Michael Bay is evolving, but in the wrong direction. And that's a fair comparison as far as it goes, but I think if you want to make a better comparison, it would be Michael Bay at age 44 making Transformers 2, to Steven Spielberg at age 47 also making Jurassic Park. And what I think is really important about that comparison is that certainly Steven Spielberg is not above pushing our emotional buttons. And you could argue that there's something kind of cynical or calculated about that if he wanted to. But Spielberg, certainly in comparison, has always been much more interested in small moments that embody an idea that are about genuine human connection. Way before he made Jurassic Park, you know, I'm thinking about Jaws, and just that tender little scene where father and son are imitating each other over the table. Spielberg movies stop for moments like that. A Bay movie doesn't stop for anything, except when you have something like Pearl Harbor, where the president, you know, the crippled president, stands up from his wheelchair because he's so indignant. You know, and I would watch a moment like that and think to myself, is that in the movie because as a moviegoer, that's what Michael Bay would find powerful? Or is he assuming that that's what the rest of us find powerful? And the thing that I keep coming back to whenever I think about Michael Bay's movies and when I write about them as I do in the book is that there is such contempt and so much hostility toward anything genuine. He doesn't need to make great art movies. He doesn't need to make great dramas. It's perfectly fine to make big, even loud action-adventure movies. You know, we have a very long and I think distinguished tradition in American cinema of doing that. But why can't they be grounded in something real, some kind of real experience that isn't just dripping with this kind of hostility toward minorities, toward intellectuals, homosexuals, toward the audience itself in terms of his style and his approach to craftsmanship.
Well, you mentioned Spielberg. I mean, just look at the Indiana Jones films, a film like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, which it's interesting you didn't discuss in your book. I know you can't possibly cover everything, but do you view a film like Raiders as an action film?
Well, you know, that's a great question. It's interesting. When you're writing a book for a publisher, it's not entirely unlike making a movie. You have a certain budget, not necessarily in terms of millions of dollars, but in pages and words. So if I was able to write a 1,000-page book, I'm sure I would have ended up writing more about Raiders and some other films that it was very difficult for me to cut. But the more substantive answer to your question is that Raiders is certainly, in a very broad sense, an action-adventure picture and one of the greatest of all time. But it doesn't really come from the tradition that I'm talking about, which is that particular constellation of the Western, the film noir, and the police procedural, and everything that exploded from there. Raiders of the Lost Ark is indebted to other traditions that I just didn't really have the space to do an entire survey of, because at this point you'd be talking about almost the entirety of American cinema.
Spielberg has talked about that as being Raiders as being taken directly from Saturday serials that he used to watch as a kid, right?
Exactly. If I was writing the book right now, I probably would talk a little bit more about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because it's consistent with this trend that we're seeing in the genre of resurrecting our older franchises and our older heroes. And I think that is a very significant trend that we're seeing.
We have the resurrection of Indiana Jones, also Rambo, Rocky. We have another Rocky film that came out a couple of years ago. Why do you think that we see these action icons being resurrected for the big screen?
There are a few reasons that we're seeing those, I think. One is that in a lot of cases, these projects had been around for a long, long time, and it just took this long for everything to fall together. You know, there were stories in the press about the development of a fourth Indiana Jones as far back as fall of 1993. Another reason is that these actors, who are all of one generation more or less, probably know that they're reaching the age where if they're ever going to recapture that lightning, it really has to be now. There isn't that much more time to wait. And related to that, these are still big brands with a lot of money-making potential globally, and why not take advantage of that if the opportunity presents itself? You know, in today's market, it's certainly one way to distinguish your action movie from someone else's brand X action movie. But there's something else I like about these revivals. In the years that they've been coming out, I think things weren't feeling too good, generally speaking. There's a lot of fear, a lot of division. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were going on and on. And as these movies would come out, I couldn't help but feel that things had this kind of ashy or polluted taste to them. And you know what? When you're in the middle of all that and you see that Superman is back, or Indy or John McClane are back, there's a much stronger feeling that the ship is being righted, much more than when it's Vin Diesel or Jason Statham. Because not only these older actors, but the characters they're playing connect you to a time that it's easier to be nostalgic about. Now, I don't know if that point is a reason we're seeing them, but I do think it's an important part of their appeal.
I think we do see, though, there's this careful distinction between, you said Superman coming back, or we've got Batman, and you've had lots of actors play those roles over the years. And they're iconic figures that they weren't created for the screen. Yeah, Superman was around long before Christopher Reeve's Superman came out in the late 70s. Whereas with Indiana Jones or with Rocky, you know, these are guys created solely as action icons on the screen and identified with their original actors. So you couldn't imagine anyone else, for instance, playing an Indiana Jones character. That's got to be Harrison Ford.
That's absolutely true. And to your examples of Superman and Batman, I would add James Bond. But I think there's still part of this overall trend and this overall feeling, which is, thank God, these guys are back. Whether it's Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones or just the property of Superman, I think there's something very reassuring about welcoming back an old friend. And if it's a familiar actor in that role, then it's that much more powerful.
Well, do you think that the recent Rocky worked very well? Because here you have Rocky at 60 years old. Of course, Stallone's still in incredible shape, but fighting the current heavyweight champion at the time, it kind of seemed to stretch the limits of credibility a bit.
Well, you know, I think that Rocky Balboa worked a lot better than the last Rambo did. And the reason for that is that they took pains in the Rocky movie to make it as credible as they possibly could. So if you're watching carefully during the fight, the champ breaks his hand. So that equalizes things a little bit. But the bigger point is that Rocky Balboa, the film, very much knows that this is impossible. And it really reflects on that, and it owns up to that. The reason I thought Rambo was more of a disappointment, even just in terms of nostalgia, forget cinematic merits, is that with both sequels, fans were waiting a very long time. It had been about 16 years since the last Rocky, and it had been almost 20 years since the last Rambo. And when you watch the stories of these sequels play out, Rocky really needed that amount of time to pass, because it's about the passage of time and what the passage of time does to us and what we feel we need to get back or recapture or purge or however you want to put it. With Rambo, there's no reason this movie could not have been made in 1992. And so the audience is not rewarded for waiting that long. You know, the fan base isn't rewarded. So that's why I think Rocky is a much more satisfying movie, because the passage of that much time makes it that much more improbable. But built into that is this great payoff if you're a fan.
And, you know, the one action icon that I've wanted to see resurrected for years has been Mad Max with Mel Gibson. And
yeah.
I think about 5 years ago, they were talking about making finally a fourth movie with Mel Gibson. I think due to reasons involving the Iraq War, they're planning to film in the Middle East, and they had some kind of problem with the shooting locations. And it kind of fell by the wayside, and now Mel Gibson said he's not going to do it anymore. So have you heard anything about that, by the way?
Nothing current. This is the story that really broke my heart as a scholar of the genre and of the series and as a fan as well. What you're talking about was a movie called Mad Max Fury Road, which I think was one of the greatest titles in action movie history. And it was Mel Gibson reuniting with George Miller. It was scheduled to start production in fall of 2003. The budget was somewhere around $104 million. This was a real movie. The sets were built. The script was done. And not long after the war started, some of the locations they had selected were, I believe, in Africa. And security concerns made that unfeasible, and the movie ended up getting shelved, and then it just went away. And I remember in the run-up to the start of production, one bad movie after another would come out, and I would just keep telling myself, it doesn't matter, because next summer, Mad Max Fury Road. I was so excited about this. And, I think it's just going to be probably the greatest movie never made.
Well, George Miller has talked about making it, but it just won't be with Mel Gibson. So I don't know if it'll at all resemble the script for the original film. So who knows?
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk over the years about rebooting the franchise, the way other franchises have been rebooted, the way we've kind of pushed the reset button on James Bond and now on Star Trek. That'll happen or it won't. It'll work or it won't. If George Miller is directing it, then I think it's got a shot at being something special. But for my money, for all the controversy that surrounded Mel Gibson, for how his star has gotten banged around, I do think it would be really remarkable to see the 1-2 punch of them together again. And, you know, one of the more controversial positions that I stake out in my book is that I actually think Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome is pretty much a work of genius, a very flawed work of genius. Unlike The Road Warrior, which I think is a perfect movie, but Beyond Thunderdome is really very special. It's funny, when I tell people this, about 9 out of 10 of them think I'm crazy, but it's always that 10th who says, I thought I was the only one who thought that. And so I do go on at some length in the book making a case for Thunderdome, because I think it's a really remarkable movie and captures a lot of the trends that are happening in 1980s action filmmaking in a pretty special, again, if flawed, way.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW, and we've been talking all about the world of action films. And my guest is Eric Lichtenfeld, who is the author of Action Speaks Louder, all about violence, spectacle, and the American action movie. And Eric is also a film scholar. He's contributed commentaries to DVDs of various landmark action pictures, such as Predator and also Die Hard and Speed. He's also contributed to Slate and The Hollywood Reporter. He's lectured at Loyola Marymount University as well, too. In terms of underrated action films, or films that, you know, the audience might have passed over, if you could list 3 or 4 films over the years, what would you recommend?
As far as underrated action movies go, I would say Death Sentence from 2007, which was about as big a piece of just pulpy exploitation as you're going to find, much less high-minded than The Brave One, which came out at the same time, but I think one of the best B-movies ever made. Some really, really fine craftsmanship in that movie. Again, on a purely pulp level. I think one of the last great modern action movies we've seen is as far back as 1997, and that's Air Force One. Solid story, a solid cast, and really exquisite filmmaking technique. And one of the things it has that's missing from so many of its contemporaries and to the films of today is just spatial clarity. We understand where all the players are in a sequence, and that is so crucial to feeling a sense of jeopardy and to being involved in the action. Yeah, I remember when it came out, the same summer Con Air came out, which was not directed by Michael Bay, but directed very much in the style of Michael Bay. And it's about convicts who take over a plane. And when we establish the interior of a plane, there's a cage. And this cage is where they keep the most dangerous psychopath. And when the movie was over, I said to my friends, where was the cage in relationship to all the seats? And everyone had a different answer. And we're talking about mapping out the geography of an airplane cabin. I mean, how hard can that be? Air Force One does it beautifully. So I think Death Sentence was unfortunately overlooked, again, as a kind of a piece of pulp. And Air Force One, I think, was a very successful movie, but I feel like it hasn't quite lingered in the public memory as much as it deserves to. One of the truly underrated action movies that the genre has seen is Red Dawn. Red Dawn is set in the early days of World War III. There is an attack on America. We're invaded. A Colorado mountain town, a few kids from the high school escape into the wilderness, become guerrillas, and fight back. And the way I describe it in the book, it's another one of those movies that really taps into that 80s zeitgeist. And the way I describe it in the book is, it's basically The Breakfast Club fights World War III. And that concept is so 80s that if a screenwriter hadn't thought of it, it would have probably just generated itself. It had to happen. And actually, when the project was being developed, it had much more of a Lord of the Flies bent to it. John Milius was brought in to make it a little more rah-rah, a little more patriotic, a little more gung-ho, but the film still retains that kind of ambivalence about what's happening to these children. I think it was Steven Spielberg who said, while he was promoting Saving Private Ryan, that all war movies are anti-war movies. And that is very true of Red Dawn, much truer than people who are too quick to dismiss it realize. You have that aspect of the film, plus it is visually absolutely stunning. It's been run on cable so much, and that's how people have gotten to know the movie, these kind of washed-out cropped transfers, that people aren't expecting it to be as beautiful as it is. But when you see a nice print of it or a good transfer on DVD, there's some really spectacular imagery. When people write about it and they talk about it, they usually dismiss it as fascist exploitation. And the fact is it's not fascist. But the bigger point is that the technique is so stunning. And the politics and the morality of the film are more complicated than people give it credit for. I recently had the opportunity to host a screening of it here in L.A. and interview one of the filmmakers on stage. And I've known this filmmaker for a long time. And one of the things that I was really excited about going into the Q&A is that I think it's a better movie than he does. I really think it's not gotten a fair shake. And so, again, one of the more controversial positions I've staked out in the book is trying to build a case for how rich that movie is. I'll let the reader decide how successfully I make that case. But I do think Red Dawn has a lot more going for it than it's usually given credit for.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And my guest has been Eric Lichtenfeld, who is a film scholar who's contributed commentaries to DVDs of various landmark action pictures, like Predator and Speed. He's also contributed to Slate and The Hollywood Reporter, and he's the author of the recent book Action Speaks Louder, which is an authoritative and entertaining study of the action film. And thanks so much for coming on the show, Eric.
Thank you, Kevin.
If you can talk a little bit about the kinds of projects that you have coming out.
There are a few projects that I'm developing right now. One is a piece for an anthology on Sylvester Stallone. My contribution is going to focus on the Rocky series. And there's a book that I'm working on, which is a study of the making and the cult status of The Warriors, Walter Hill's 1979 film. I'm a huge fan of the movie, and I'm actually a huge fan of the year 1979. I think it was a really fascinating and just wonderful year for the movies, and so I'm looking forward to kind of rooting around in some of that. And there are a few other larger scale follow-ups to Action Speaks Louder that I'm kicking around. A few ideas kind of vying in contention with each other right now, so we'll see what shakes out.
Oh, yeah, The Warriors, which we didn't get a chance to talk about. You know, I actually have not seen The Warriors. I've read the book, which, Walter Hill? No, it's not.
Walter Hill. Walter,
he's a director. Okay.
Saul Urich wrote the novel.
Yes, yes. I did read the book a number of years ago. Supposedly the book's a lot darker than the film. I certainly look forward to checking that out. So thank you once again, Eric, for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
For Eric Lechtenfeld, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. For more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.